had a little chat. We were talking about a text box chatting, and I set something up, and I have a URL. And if people will want to come on, we'll see if this will work or not. But it's www.urwebchat.com/technet. Again, that's www.usinuniformrsinradiowebchat.com/technet. Wow, what took so long? I'm having fun with you, Lou. Okay, www.urwebchat.com/technet. So I think you're saying this already exists. You've set this up and people can start chatting with each other right now. Back to you for confirmation on all this, Lou. NY2H, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Affirmative, Dick. It's a free chatting service, so there was nothing for me really to set up except this little account. Somebody just came on, NY2SI just came on. Hi, Luke, so I guess it's working. Very good. So we have one. And someone else came in as a guest, so we've got three people on already. That's terrific. urwebchat.com/technet. And also, we had a couple of people that gave us some good info on the RFI mail address before, so we thank them for that. This is NY2H.
Okay, I'm going to repeat what Hal just said. Lou just said, and that is when you hear things that you think shouldn't be there, like we did have in the beginning of the TechNet tonight, and you go to the reverse mode where you're listening to the input frequency, 146.25, for instance, on this 2585 repeater, and you tell us at exactly what hour, what did you hear, how strong, what direction, if you have a way of determining direction of arrival, and in some cases it's a weak signal and you had to go to the single sideband mode to hear it. So tell us what you heard. And so Lou did already have a number of reports already on rfi.limark.org. rfi@limark.org is where that gets reported. And so now there's a chat room, www.urwebchat.com/technet. Alrighty, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead with the mailbag there, John.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick. And Paul, if you're out there, I haven't heard him, but he could be lurking there somewhere. Let me drop him on, go to the first one.
I tried to get in earlier, John, WS2N.
You sounded good, Paul. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, we have a gentleman by the name of Roy who sent a very interesting question. He would like to know why 50 ohms of impedance was chosen for antennas. Why not 70, 73, something like that, 72? Why did they settle on 50 ohms? Back to you, Dick.
It's arbitrary. When it comes to coaxial cable, the United States has a kind of a standard where we like coaxial cables to be 50 ohms. Europe is mostly 70 ohms, but there's portions of the United States that are also 70. The cable television system is almost all 70 ohm hardline cable, because 70 ohm cable for the same method of construction gives you less loss than 50, and they've got to lay a whole lot of miles of cable for the cable television system throughout a town. And something like 14 amplifiers per mile are required to keep boosting up that signal that's being attenuated by those miles of cable. And so you need less amplifiers per mile if you use 70 ohm cable than 50 ohm cable. And with the usual method of construction, a 70 ohm cable is a little bit lighter in pounds per foot than 50 ohm. So the cable people are 70 ohm, but for a bunch of reasons, the United States chose 50 ohms, and you get a little bit of a hint from that. Let me drop. When you go to Marino's book, Transmission Line Techniques, I think it is, by Marino. This is a 1952 book when Mr. Marino was working for the Sperry Gyroscope Company. Very well done book. And he talks about various impedances of coax cable. 35-ohm coax cable, it gives you the highest possible power handling capability. 70 or 72 ohms gives you the lowest insertion loss. gives you the highest voltage capability and 120 ohms. I forget what the magic there was. In other words, Marino's book tells you that each one of these impedances you could have chosen for coax cable have various advantages. The 50 ohms is kind of a compromise between the highest power handling of 35 ohms and the lowest insertion loss of 70 ohms. So 50 is kind of a compromise, and maybe that's one of the reasons why the United States has established 50 as a standard for coaxial cables. Let me drop. And most of our pieces of instrumentation in the United States are 50 ohm referenced. Your signal generators, your receivers, your spectrum analyzers, your vector network analyzers, your time domain reflectometers, almost all of the instrumentation that you can buy in the United States is 50 ohm referenced. Quite a bit of that instrumentation in Europe is 70 ohm referenced, because they like lower insertion loss, and so they've gone that way. Now, once you've established that all of your test equipment is 50 ohms, and that some of the most popular coax cables you use are 50 ohms, it sort of stands to reason you would adjust the antenna for 50 ohms. Let me drop on that one. If you know what you're doing when you're designing an antenna, and somebody told you, I want that antenna to have an input impedance of 35 ohms, and this antenna, I want to have an input impedance of 50 ohms, and that antenna, I want to have an input impedance of 75 ohms, and this antenna, I want to have an input impedance of 150 ohms. And I want you to ship me all four of those antennas. If somebody made that request, at first you would say, the guy's crazy. Well, there may be a damn good reason he's got that as a request. It's not an unreasonable request. And if you know what you're doing with a simple dipole, which is being used as either a dipole in free space or a dipole that's the driven element of a Yagi, the so-called dipole, the majority of hams, the majority of antenna engineers, if I interview them and I ask them, what would you do to make those different impedances, they come up with all kinds of mechanical doodads, T-match, gamma match, folded dipole, and whatever, all kinds of mechanical doodads to get those various impedances they think is required. Absolutely not. Let me drop. I've written an article on this subject, and a number of people who are running antenna companies have told me, boy, it's about time that somebody put that in writing. And I've tried getting the article published, and various publishers don't want to publish it because they think everybody knows what a dipole is, and it's too boring to discuss impedance matching of a dipole. Okay. You go to the WA1MBA.org, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha dot, I think it's dot org, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, Tom Williams' website. You go to the bottom of his website, and you'll find impedance matching by K2RIW. And you read those 1,500 words, and here's what you're going to find out. You tell me what resistive impedance you want for your dipole. I don't care if it's a folded dipole, an inverted V, a dipole that's part of a Yagi, a dipole that's buried inside of a piece of waveguide, no matter where your dipole-like antenna is. You tell me what resistive component you want it to have, and I can tell you exactly how to go there. Let me drop. You simply change the length of the dipole, and you change the impedance. At first, you're going to say, hey, that's not the right way to go. I'll be tuning it to do different frequencies if I change the length. Not necessarily. You go to those two curves that are the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, which are on Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and they're also in that WA1MBA.org, bottom of the page. You go to those two curves, the reactive curve, the resistive curve, and the 1,500-word article that goes with it, and you read it and understand it, and you'll say, wow, why hasn't somebody told me that before? By changing nothing but the length of a dipole, you can make it go from 1 ohm to 1,500 ohms inclusive resistive component. You can make the resistive component anywhere from 1 ohm to 1,500 ohms by changing nothing but the length. However, if it wasn't 70 ohms that you were looking for, where it happens to be the so-called resonant length, less than 70 ohms, you're going to make it shorter than halfway long. Greater than 70 ohms, you're going to make it greater than a halfway long. Whenever you adjust the length to get the right resistive component, 99% of the time there's a reactive component left over. By simply putting a capacitor, an inductor, or an inductor, the right value, across the center of the dipole, the reactive component and now you're on the right frequency with whatever impedance you want. If you want to design a 33-ohm impedance dipole antenna, which is maybe part of a Yagi, maybe it's an inverted E, whatever. If you want 33 ohms, you make it the right amount shorter than half wavelength. It will come down from 73 ohms to 33 ohms resistive component. When you do that, there's a capacitive reactance component left over. And you'll have to put a shunt inductor in there to correct that. You put the right value of shunt inductor.
Repeater, timeout.
You put the right value of shunt inductor. The reactive component is now gone. The resistive component you wanted for 33 ohms, you've got it, and it's hunky-dory. So, 50 ohms is a standard impedance for antennas because our instrumentation and our cables are 50 ohms, but there's nothing magic about it. If you want some other number of ohms of your antenna, some of my patents have done exactly that, you tell me what number of ohms of impedance you want, and I can easily design it for you with no fancy doodads, just adjusting the length and putting a single reactor at the center of the antenna, and you're there. For some reason, that is not taught in any of the schools. It is not mentioned in any of the books. It's the world's best-kept secret. You guys know it. Make sure you don't tell anybody. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the second end.
KC2WGB, yeah, I won't say a word. I'm sure Roy will be happy with that information. And, we've got all 50-ohm instrumentation. Most of the construction is 50-ohm in the RF world, so now we're stuck with it. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. Okay, quite a few months ago, we had a discussion about noise and measuring noise in a quiescent state, such as a resistor or a diode or even a piece of steel. We had this conversation last night. Well, this gentleman would like to know, where does that noise come from, how is it developed, and how it's detected? So maybe you can give him some pointers on that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
In the world of modern-day electronics, particularly in the case of very sensitive receivers like a radio telescope, everything makes noise. And all we have to discuss is how much noise, where is it coming from, how do I get rid of it, or how do I learn to live with it? Everything makes noise. Your body is making an extremely easily measured amount of radio noise because you're warmer than the background. Yes, you can see it with a near-infrared or a far-infrared, a forward-looking infrared receiver, FLIR receiver. You can see the fact that the body is hot, and if you're standing in front or if you're standing behind a bush, people can easily see you with that kind of infrared equipment. But radio-wise, you're also making a lot of noise. Your thermometer measures something we call temperature. Everybody thinks, what is temperature? Hot and cold. Well, that's sort of true. There's a lot more to the story. The thermometer is measuring average kinetic energy of the molecules. And some of the stuff you're about to hear is going to be stranger than fiction. The first time you hear it, you're going to say, I don't believe that, and I don't blame you. But as you dig a little bit deeper, you're going to find out there's a fair amount of truth in what I'm about to say. Let me drop. Everything that's above absolute zero in temperature has got real motion of its atoms and molecules. The air in the room with you right now is moving 500 meters per second, average speed of those air molecules, because they're at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average speed of the air molecules in the room with you now, that gas. You take that gas and you, if it happened to be water vapor and you cool it so that it's now a liquid, the water molecules in the liquid are moving like something like 640 meters per second. You freeze it so that it's ice, or you take a chunk of steel and you measure with your thermometer the steel is at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And so what does that mean? Those individual molecules of the steel are bouncing back and forth in position. They're held together in a matrix, into a lattice. But in between each of those steel molecules is a bunch of springs, and they're all bouncing back and forth on their springs. And the average kinetic energy of their bouncing is what your thermometer measures. And you start heating up that steel, and they're bouncing more and more violently. You heat up the steel enough with a blowtorch, and it starts glowing red, and eventually yellow and white, because it starts emitting noise so loud, so to speak, optically speaking, that's what you're seeing, and that's what your thermometer will measure. Let me drop. Once you recognize that each of these molecules are moving, everything at some temperature is moving. You can't stop that happening. That's what's happening at the molecular level. You've never seen it, so it's hard to accept, but take my word for it. Everything is moving. If the basic molecule is moving, meaning the nucleus, which is where 99.9% of the mass is located, the nucleus is moving, and the electron cloud around that nucleus is married to that nucleus, and therefore that electron cloud is moving with the nucleus. In the case of copper, for instance, you've got two extra electrons in the outer ring that are very free to move. That's why copper is such a good conductor. Even though the individual copper molecules are locked together in a matrix, as long as it's not melted copper, but still the electrons are free to move. And as the individual copper molecules, copper atoms, are bouncing around on their springs, and the electrons connected to them are moving with those, you've now got moving electrons, you've got random noise being generated. Everything that's got any kind of a temperature is making random electronic noise, radio noise, electronic noise, call it what you like. Now, here's a crazy puzzle. Assume I've got four boxes in front of me, and there's a coaxial connector on each one of the boxes, and with all the instrumentation I've got, my ohmmeter, my vector network analyzer, whatever, I find out that each one of the connectors is a 50 ohm resistance. Okay? You didn't know it, but one of those boxes has got a 50 ohm carbon resistor inside, carefully made so that it doesn't have any reactants. It's a pure 50 ohm resistor. Another box has got a thin sheet of copper foil inside, and the thin sheet of copper foil is so thin that it also measures 50 ohms. Another box is made out of a thin sheet of steel inside, at just the right length and dimension, so it's 50 ohms. So I've got a 50 ohm steel resistor in one box, a 50 ohm copper resistor in another box, and a 50 ohm carbon resistor.
Repeater, timeout.
And a 50 ohm carbon resistor in the third box. And now you start making measurements. And I ask you, tell me which box is a carbon, which box is copper, which box is steel, by making measurements on the outside world. They all measure exactly 50 ohms with your ohmmeter or 50 ohms with your vector network analyzer. The next thing you do is you connect a real good spectrum, a real good radio telescope, as if it's listening to a weak signal from a star with an antenna, but you're connecting it to these boxes with the dummy load inside. And you'll be amazed. Assuming that all three boxes are at the same physical temperature, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, for instance, something like 293 degrees Kelvin, they're all at the same physical temperature, so all will measure the exact same amount of radio noise. The random motion of those carbon molecules, the copper molecules, and the steel molecules, the random motion is moving those electrons, the electrons moving around are making noise, and the exact amount of noise at room temperature is minus 114 dBm per megahertz. If you're using a radio telescope, which has got a 1 megahertz wide IF strip, and you measure the amount of noise coming out of that 50 ohm resistor, let me drop. You will measure amount of power that is minus 114 dBm per megahertz. 114 dB weaker than 1 milliwatt, that's what dBm means. It's approximately a quarter of a microvolt. You'll measure a quarter of a microvolt on the carbon resistor, a quarter of a microvolt on the steel resistor, a quarter of a microvolt on the copper resistor. The material that it's made out of doesn't matter. The different material means you've got to have a different thickness and a different length because it's got different resistivity in order to come up with 50 ohms. But once it comes up to 50 ohms, that's the power you will get. Here's another crazy thing that you can't read about. As long as I impedance match, it doesn't matter if it's 50 ohms. I could have a 20 ohm resistor in all three of those boxes. And now I measure, I have an impedance match 20 ohm radio telescope receiver. As long as there's an impedance match between the resistor and the receiver, I will get the exact same amount of power, minus 114 dBm per megahertz. Because it's a lower resistor, it's a slightly different number of microvolts and a higher number of microamperes, but it will equal the exact same power. Once you know the temperature and your impedance match, You know the exact power you're going to get. It's a science, traceable to the Bureau. Here's a couple of more crazy things about this. Let me drop. The exact noise power you get is exactly equal to the temperature in degrees Kelvin. Room temperature is approximately 290 Kelvin, according to the IEEE standard. If I go to half that temperature, half of 290 is 145 degrees Kelvin. If I go to 145 degrees Kelvin, I'll get exactly half the noise power. Minus 114 dBm, half of that, 3 dB lower, 114 minus 3 is minus 117. I'll get minus 117 dBm per megahertz if I cool that resistor to 145 degrees Kelvin. Or conversely, if I heat it up, if I go to twice 290, which is what, 580 degrees Kelvin, I'll get twice 114, I'll get minus 111 dBm per megahertz. The radio telescopes do exactly that. They have a standard resistor that they flip back and forth. This is called the Dickey switching technique for calibrating your radio telescope. Let me drop. In the front end of my radio telescope, I've got a single pole double throw relay, and I flip back and forth between the antenna that's aimed at a cold star, what I think is a cold star, a hot star. I'm aiming at a cold part of space that's got a star. I've got the antenna aimed at a star, and I want to measure how much radio noise I'm getting out of the star. I flip the relay to the antenna, and I measure the star. Then I flip the relay over to my standard resistor that I can control the temperature of, and I measure the noise power out of the resistor, I measure the noise power out of the antenna, I compare the two, and now I've got a calibration of noise power coming out of that star traceable to the Bureau. In some cases, they cool the resistor, they heat the resistor, they do various things in order to match the two or have a known difference between the two. So temperature is noise power when you impedance match, and it doesn't depend on frequency. I could make the measurement at 2 megahertz, I could make the measurement at 20 megahertz, 200 megahertz, 2 gigahertz, 20 gigahertz. I'll get the same answer. Minus 114 dBm per megahertz at room temperature. Ain't that crazy? It's not until I get to the really high frequencies where you start getting a roll-off because of another phenomenon. But at most of the radio frequencies you and I care about, the noise power is very predictable, and it's a method I could use to measure temperature. Let me drop. Now, I built a radio telescope, and I didn't even know I was doing that. I took that 12-foot diameter dish that you could read about in August 1972 QST magazine. That was the article about the dish. The June issue 1972 QST magazine is called, the article is called, Houston, this is Apollo. It's where I used that 12-foot dish aimed at the moon to listen to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts at 2287.5 megahertz, downlink frequency command service module. And in order to test that antenna, whether or not it's working well, I was literally aiming it at the sun and then aiming it at a cold sky, using the sun as a noise source and cold sky as a noise source, and look at the difference in the noise power coming out of the receiver. But while I'm aiming the antenna at the cold sky, I wanted to readjust the feed horn in front of the dish. I stood on top of a wooden chair in front of this 12-foot parabolic dish, and I noticed that when I stood there, the needle measuring noise power out of the receiver went up. The S-band signal coming out of my body, the random noise radio signal, because I'm warmer than cold sky, it went up. I was doing a radio telescope measurement of me, even though I wasn't in the focal point of the dish, if you know what I mean. I was in front of the dish, the majority of the dish was looking at cold sky, and when I stood on that wooden chair, I watched the noise power go up because of my noise power coming out of me. And I suddenly realized that all I could do if I wanted to is aim this dish through a sheetrock wall, which is reasonably transparent in S-band. If there's a man standing on the other side of that wall, I could measure the increase in noise power because of the radio noise emitted by that man standing on the other side of that quasi-transparent wall. That's radio astronomy. That's radiometry. Everything makes noise. If it's a resistor you've got contact to, let me drop. It's a resistor that you've got a cable connected to, and you can measure the noise in microvolts, dBm, whatever units you like. And as long as your impedance match, I can tell you exactly what temperature that resistor is at. If it's connected to an antenna, and you put a warm or a cold object in front of the antenna, the noise power coming out of the antenna goes up and down accordingly. If I was using an antenna that half a degree of beamwidth, and I aimed it at the moon, which is a half a degree wide object, so that the whole beamwidth of the antenna is aimed at the moon, and now I measure the noise power coming out of that receiving antenna, I am measuring the temperature of the moon. And they have done that. And you do it when the moon is full moon or a new moon, and which means the surface aimed towards you is either at high noon and it's being heated by the sun, or it's in the darkness and it's being cold. You can literally measure the temperature of the moon by aiming an antenna out of it, at it, and measure the noise power coming out of your antenna. Ain't that interesting? KC2WGB, K2LAW in the Tech Net.
KC2WGB. Great information, Nick. That's a lot of information on something that you would not think is that complicated. But, yeah, great. I'm sure he has a better understanding now. Okay. I think we should go to Paul because it's rather late. My guys are probably headed off to bed. But, good net.
There's a lot more to radiometry, but you've heard enough to scratch the surface. And if you got the right kind of curiosity, it should make you say, gee, I want to know more about that. Now you know something about what's being done in the case of the Transportation Security Authority at airports. You have a sensitive enough receiver, you aim it at a human being, you can get a thermal image at radio frequencies of that human being, and through his clothing you'll see whether or not he's carrying a gun, a knife, or whatever. With the right kind of radiometry equipment, and there are people building equipment that can do that. It's not cheap equipment, but you can measure the noise power coming out of a human being. You can make if you've got high enough resolution of the antenna, you can make a picture of that human being at thermal images, at RF frequencies, and resolve objects that he's hiding under his clothing. In some cases, you can even resolve objects that he is hidden inside of his body. There's no limit to how far this can go. Paul? What's NASA doing this week? WS2N, K2LIW, and TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Hey, Dick. This is WS2N. Well, they canceled the Galax Space Telescope. I think I remember talking about this about 10 years ago when it was launched. And it was launched on a Pegasus rocket. We've talked about the Pegasus rocket a lot. In fact, we talked about it last week, that put the telescope up that's going to look at the sun's surface. And the Pegasus rocket is put up by Orbital Science. They've been launching dozens, I don't know, probably over 50 of these things successfully over the 10, 15 years. So the Galax telescope, it's an ultraviolet telescope. It's been looking at galaxies, black holes, and all. It's the Galaxy Evolution Explorer, what they called it. And it's been functioning. I think it had like a 3-year mission, and that went on to over 10 years. And what they did is they turned it over to some college. I forget which group. I think it might have been California Institute of Technology. Drop it. Did that last year. And a little over a year. And they got to use it. The funding ran out on the Galax. And NASA dropped it. But the school picked it up. But again, there's no more funding. NASA was helping support the mission. It's 400 miles, a little over 400 miles up, and it's not going to go anywhere. They don't have to worry about this thing deorbiting for over 60 more years. So they kind of pulled the plug on it, but it did a good job, and all in ultraviolet. So that thing is canceled, but a very successful program, and it wasn't all that expensive. I think couple hundred million dollars over a lifetime, you know, just usage that they put into it. So another telescope we talk about all the time, Kepler. Drop it.
on this thing. I mean, this came out today that NASA's going to try to revive the Kepler spacecraft. And this is the one that points in one direction at all 150,000 stars. And it looks at the planets going in front of it and all the stars that dim out a little bit. This thing has figured out that it's probably a planet if it sees it on a regular basis. And because it's pointing at one point in the sky all the time, it's not in orbit around the Earth, it's in orbit around the Sun, so it could look at the one spot like forever. And by doing this, it's come out with over 3,000 possible planets. I think 130 or 140 confirmed. And they believe when they go through the rest of them, let me drop it. According to the average that they've been working on, they believe out of those 3,000, about 90% will be confirmed planets. So it's a very successful telescope, and they'd like to get it back going again. So about early May, they had a final failure of the reaction wheels. It's got four reaction wheels to keep it oriented properly in space and looking at the same spot. Three were functional all the time, and the other one was a backup. So eventually, having one fail, and the backup came online, and that was okay. And then last May, another reaction wheel failed. And these things are, you know, they're not like gyroscopes. They're similar to gyroscopes, but gyroscope will actually hold the spacecraft in some position. And you could actually rotate this, move the space the spacecraft with these reaction wheels. They're much smaller than the standard gyroscopes that go on the spacecraft. And they spin up to maybe 6,000 RPMs, and then by changing the speed of the spinning flywheels, you can actually move the spacecraft a little bit one way or the other. Well, it needs three. X-axis, Y-axis, and Z-axis. You have it. The spacecraft properly oriented. The Japanese had an interplanetary failure with one of their spacecraft, Hayabusa, years ago. It was going to bring back some asteroid fragments or something, but it had the same kind of problem with these reaction wheels. And you know, momentum wheels. But that turned out to be pretty successful because they relied on their thrusters after that. Kepler can't do that. You've only got so much fuel, and that's about it. So it turns out NASA is going to, I don't know how they're going to do it, but they're going to try to revive at least one of those wheels, momentum wheels. And if that's successful, they would be able to put Kepler back in operation. If not, it looks like that would be the end of the mission. It went up in 2009 for a three-year mission. Here we are in 2013. So it's been very successful. If it fails, it would be actually the end of that mission of staring at one spot in space. But they think they could use it for kind of like a sky survey type of thing. You know, they'll let it drift one way or the other, and they're going to use this thing. They're pretty good. NASA's pretty good at when a spacecraft kind of like dies out, they can keep them going if they find some value in it. So I hope they get Kepler going back to, you know, getting back to operation. It's a $600 million project. But very well worth it, in my opinion. And that's pretty much it, except for we've got July 20th coming up, the first landing on the moon anniversary. I know Limoch has a special event type of station. Got to get more details. Maybe the club net, or the info net on Monday night, 8:30, when we drop it. We have that at the Cradle of Aviation. They want to set up a radio there and transmit. Don't have any real details. place, and Long Island was part of that with Grumman building all of Lems, all six Lems that successfully landed on the moon, and returned 12 people from that surface. And of course, the well, probably the most famous one is using the Aquarius Lem for Apollo 13 as a lifeboat to return three astronauts, Lowell, Hayes, Schweiger, back to Earth successfully after their service module blew an oxygen tank. That's pretty much it, Dick. Let me give out the email. A question, the topics you want to hear on the net. You could write to me, SpaceNetReport. So it's SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. One word, of course. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Thank you, Paul. Depending on which website you go to, some of them are claiming that Kepler has discovered 800 or 900 planets. Maybe there's a little bit of anticipation there. In other words, they think that it's not an absolute positive confirmation of those planets, but good enough confirmation. So I've heard numbers as high as 800 or 900 confirmed. Certain websites are saying that. And so an absolute, you know, perfect confirmation is a smaller number, and thousands, at least something like 3,000 candidates. And in the best world, you'd like to be able to see the planet that is a candidate as a planet, the thing that crossed in front of that star. You'd like to see it come around the second time or the third time, and you really get a good confirmation. There's another website, let me drop. There's another website I've seen which tells you the extremes. How cold, how hot, how much water, how much lava, and so on. Some of these planets are supersized Jupiter-like things, or bigger than Jupiter, real close, closer than the planet Mercury. One of the planets that's recently been discovered, supposedly by Kepler, is now the greatest distance from its star. And I seem to remember it was... I think it was 8 billion miles. In other words, roughly twice the distance of Pluto is a planet that has been discovered. And the main method they discovered it is because as the planet goes around that star, it is sweeping away the dust in the orbit of the planet. And they've seen the dust being swept away in the planet, if I understand correctly. But there are all kinds of extremes. You'd like to believe all the planets would look like Earth. Not in the world, man. Not like that at all. We're in the Goldilocks zone, midway between too close where it's too hot and too far away where it's too cold, and water can be primarily a liquid form, and there's enough water on board. We are kind of lucky along those lines. Let me drop. But a couple of decades ago, we used to believe that planets going around a star were once in a million chance. And now we realize that essentially every star has got planets. Now we're looking for the good planets. Now that we realize there's a hell of a lot more star, hell of a lot more planets. In fact, you could almost say it's a rare star that doesn't have planets. And I think the majority of the ones that have been confirmed are the planets that are unary stars, but more stars are binaries than unaries. Our star happens to be alone, but there's a hell of a lot more stars that are binaries, and they've been finding planets around those binaries, although they're a little bit more rare. It's a little bit more difficult to get the stability that way. And there was another point I was going to make. I think I'm going to drop the information I was going to give you guys about the Large Hadron Collider. Paul and I, correction, John and I, had a discussion last night about what that machine can do. Oh, man, can that accelerate a whole lot of particles at extremely high velocities? And it uses something like 120 megawatts of power to run the machine at full blast. That Large Hadron Collider that's... run by CERN, that goes between Switzerland and France, 27-kilometer diameter tube with these particles in there moving 99.99% the speed of light. You put 8 nine in a row, followed by a one. That's how close they get to the speed of light. A couple of meters per second slower than the speed of light, which is 300 million meters per second. So they're really getting up there. I know that Wes wanted us to discuss some of the websites that he's been discovering. And I know that at least one of the websites you haven't yet seen, John.
Repeater, time out.
My computer is being replaced. I've got a 10-year-old computer, a real clunker. And my son has made me a super fast machine, but it's not yet installed in the Hemtrack. It's in another room being rung out. So right now I have no internet connection. I do have email, not email. I have no email connection. I've got internet access by way of Google, but I don't have internet. I don't have email connection at this time. That'll be all restored next week. But if I understand correctly, Wes, you have discovered another website that you believe is showing you something significant. So let me turn it over to Wes and have him give a description of what he found. N2XJN, K2LAW in the TechNet.
For a quick commercial?
Yeah, go ahead, Bernie.
For anybody who would like to see these links that Wes is producing, they're very interesting information. And if you'd like to be able to have access to them without having to retype them or Google them yourself, drop me an email. Go to QRZ. My call sign is K2YO. And my email address is there. And drop me an email, and I can get you access to the Dropbox that has all of this information. So it lets you follow along with what Wes and Dick are talking about. And it's easy to do. Just send me an email. In fact, I'll just give out my email address. It's Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E, at Hunt Family. My last name is Hunt, H-U-N-T, huntfamily.com. So just drop me an email, and I'll get you an invitation to the Dropbox, and you'll be in on the information. Now back to your regular scheduled program, Wes.
Thank you very much, N2XJN. I hope Glenn is there, because I sent the email to Glenn and John as well. The first one was a few days ago, but then I wanted to specify more the information I sent today, the one that is actually looking the same. If you see more of email, and usually that the email that says which revision is, so revision 1, 2, 3, or whatsoever, but mostly it's repeating the same one. Let me jump. Previously thought that Moon doesn't have a water at all, and there is enough water on Moon to make 1 meter, which would be 3 feet all around the Moon. Part of that is in volcanic structure, part of that is in the chemical structure. And that is, again, based on NASA research, and it's official information, not something that somebody just made up. Let me just... A NASA-funded research project has discovered the existence of unexplained portals between Earth and Sun, which would be the time portals. The NASA has turned science fiction into the science fact by announcing the discovery of hidden portals in the Earth magnetic field. It was called an X point or electron diffusion region, which is the phenomenon that is responsible for existence of those portals. Rather than being intergalactic faults in the space leading to different galaxies and planets. So those portals aid in the transfer of magnetic field from the Sun to Earth. But essentially, those portals aid in the transfer of tons of magnetically charged particles that flow from Sun, causing the northern southern light and geomagnetic storms. We call them X-points of electron diffusion regions, And University of Iowa is one of the divisions working with NASA, and they work on plasma effects with Jack Scudder, who is one of the leading physicists over there, and they place where the magnetic field of the Earth connects to the magnetic field of the Sun, creating an uninterrupted path leading from our own planet to the Sun atmosphere, which would be 93 million miles away. But anyhow, when you look closer at that, you will find out that the magnetic field is transferred into mass. As strange as it sounds, as unbelievable as it sounds, when you go to the electron diffusion region, and especially we try to go to the tridimensional magnetic reconnection, you will find that the energy is being transferred to mass and reverse, which then it might be a key to plenty of other phenomena, and should not sound really funny. The Vernet was making a books that were total science fiction. Now, plenty of that is reality. That much for now. We have additional thing which would be a short problem with the speed and light and relativity problem. This is the second part of it. And if you have a time, please listen to the whole deal, please, that the video that is attached to it, and then think about and, you know, just think if it's possible. We have a problem that conveying full awareness of that. I mean, we have a speed of light, and what's happened when we reach the speed of light? Now, if we are in able to reach those portals, and those portals, there was a spacecraft that was specially sent to investigate that phenomena. We have a situation at which a speed light might of be reached, but at the same time, it looks like from other articles that the law of conservation of energy, or say the EMC square, it might not really be out of questions. That part of that video that I'm talking about right now says about what's happened if we reach the speed of light, and what's happened to the viewers, and what's happened to the people that are traveling at speed of light. Also, if we connect two together, which would be the existence of the X points and the relativity problem that is described in another video, when we would say that science fiction-wise, we might have a structure, then it's mapped, then it's taken to the pieces, and then sent, or even not sent, but recreated in another part of the Earth, or maybe another planet. And now speech depends for what medium we use. If mass equals energy, energy equals mass, then the energy of light will be achievable. And at first, I believe if there is an experiment, there would be an experiment with steady-state devices or objects, not with the human being. That's for those two videos. Back to you.
How many people have seen these videos that you've recommended, these YouTube videos, Wes? Do you believe Glenn has seen them? I know that John has not, and to your knowledge, you've seen them, and It sounds to me like you believe that it's showing some fairly new and exciting material. Has Glenn said what his impression is of them yet, Wes, in 2XJN, K2RAW?
I don't know that, but there is for sure, and there is not the recent discovery, it's known, and it's claimed that Moon has a platinum, has a water, and has fuel for spacecraft. That's what is there, and it's not just speculation, it's a fact. And if you look at that video about the claim of water, platinum, and fuel, you see a dozen of sites just simply taking the material from NASA and putting it as it is. So you might have a little bit different title of it, but the material when you look at it is the same one. Now, you have also a few sites that will speculate on it, but I gave you a few scientific papers which states about the super, one is super alpine propagation of superstorm reconnection signatures and pointing flux, which would be magnetic reconnection, which magnetic reconnection is directly attached to electron diffusion that is then responsible for existence of those portals. And electron diffusion region is being called EDR. You have also two documents. One is from geophysical point of view, which would be geophysical research letter from 2007. And then you have another one, which would be then, I'm trying to get into it, yes. Evidence for elongated ion skin depth electron diffusion region during the fast magnetic reconnection. Fast magnetic reconnection. So you have a few documents that will explain actually the phenomena, and one who reads them would not have a problem with my specific accent. Good to you.
Yeah, for some time now, a number of satellites and other kinds of measurements of the moon was giving hints that the moon does contain water below the surface. And so people have in the past made predictions that we would eventually colonize the moon. And it makes good science fiction. However, it's going to be expensive to get mankind there, to get him back by way of manufacturing rocket fuel by using water and other materials that you find on the moon sounds like a possibility. However, the rigmarole you got to go through to capture that moon water is not going to be easy. And so I'm of the opinion that we're not going to see moon colonization anytime soon. And what would be the main reason for doing it when it comes to searching the materials on the moon in order to try to figure out the origin of the Earth and the moon? Let me drop. The origin of the solar system, Earth, Sun, Moon. By studying those materials, you could do that with unmanned vehicles. To send a man there is nowhere near as difficult, as easy as you think. To maintain a man in a vacuum of space, and the moon is pretty hard in vacuum, it's rather difficult. When you calculate the fact that each breath you take on average is a liter of air, and you take something like 20 breaths per minute, and you start calculating how many tons of air flows through your body per day. I think I calculated that I use up all the volume of the air in my house in less than a month. And if I'm going to be maintained on the moon for years, somebody's got to supply all of that air. That's not easy. That's just the air, water, and fuel. As you know, to keep a man alive, it's not easy. When you sit in a theater seat, and you're not doing anything. You're not jumping it down. You're not screaming. You're just sitting there listening to an opera, we'll say. You're burning up 135 watts. Your 135-watt incandescent light bulb, as far as the rate of metabolism of your body. You're consuming food, fuel, water, air, in order to create metabolism to continuously make 135 watts. If you're going to be alive, you're going to be doing that. Start exercising, those numbers go up real fast. So 35 watts of energy every second, every hour, every day, for a year, requires quite a bit of resources. You start eating up that material of your body pretty fast if you stop eating and stop drinking. I think the rough rule of thumb is you can live for 3 days without water, and I think it's a
repeater, timeout.
I think they have a rough rule of thumb they use. They call it the threes. You can live without air for 3 minutes. You can live without water for 3 days. You can live without food for 3 weeks. You exceed any of those numbers, and your survivability is pretty low. So maintaining a man on the moon is not going to be easy. And the man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, touched on the moon, I guess it was July 20th, 1969, 44 years ago. So at Cradle of Aviation, we're going to be holding a celebration of kind for an event of 44 years ago. Quite often you hold a celebration on the 25th and the 50th and so on anniversary. The 44th year is not one where we normally hold, but let me ask that one to Paul. Do you believe that the Cradle of Aviation, by way of Limark, will be holding a kind of a celebration of July 20th almost every year from now on? WS2N, if you're there, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, listening to Rich, K2KNB, he was talking about that last week on the InfoNet. So apparently if they're going to shoot for this every year, just like they had the, you know, they wanted to have the Lindbergh flight. You know, they're involved somehow with the Cradle of Aviation recently. I thought they were going to put a repeater there or something. I'm not sure. I don't know the details, but get on the club net. We'll get more information tomorrow night at 8:30. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Another thing that has come out this week, the microwave reflector, these 300 or so guys worldwide that are pretty heavily involved in microwave ham radio, the fairly rare guys, they're all sending all kinds of emails back and forth over the last few days about an article that appeared in Science Magazine last week. And these are called the fast radio bursts. I may have the FRBs, I may have the letters wrong, but I think it's fast radio bursts. They're discovering that you set up anything that looks like a radio telescope, and you aim it at any direction in the sky you want, and you wait a little while, you're going to find a millisecond burst of RF energy, which when you do the calculation as to how far away and how strong, it's just mind-blowing numbers. You can get a hint about how far away a radio burst was because of the way the free particles, let me call it the dark matter of space, modifies the velocity of propagation. When you get something a couple of galaxies away from you, let me drop. When something a couple of galaxies away from you transmits a very strong burst of radio energy that encompasses a whole lot of frequencies, it's broadband, you'll discover that the lower frequency components arrive at your radio telescope late. That gives you a hint as to how much material in free space it interacted with. There's enough particles in free space that will slow down the